Campus FM presents a talk entitled On the Strange Place of Religion in Contemporary Art by Professor James Elkins. The talk was organized by the art program within the Faculty of Education.
First, I have to thank Raphael for 2 days of relentlessly efficient touring, during which he took me to see absolutely everything except that neighborhood called Les Due Bali, which he won't take me to, but everything else I've seen. Thanks to him, he's a fabulous tour guide. So this talk is based on my book, which has this title, but actually this talk is about something slightly different. I'm going to take 5 themes out of the book and talk about ways that religion is related to contemporary art. So I suppose this is a bit more optimistic than the book itself, which is somewhat pessimistic. I want to start out with some preliminary definitions just for the purpose of this talk. What I'm going to be talking about under the name of religion is any named non-cultic system of belief. I do this kind of thing in the book too. I have a number of friends who work in seminaries and in other institutions, and they advise me not to try to use the word without defining it, and yet not to define it in any way that I would be held to. So these are provisional definitions for this talk. Spirituality, then, is anything that's partly private, non-liturgical, outside of the cultus, partly incommunicable, taken to be partly incommunicable, but is a system of belief. Given these definitions, then, my starting point would be that talk of religion is virtually absent in the art world, and talk of spirituality is very rare. And the main reason that I wrote this book was to try to bridge a gulf which I think has become increasingly deep and wide between people who are mostly my friends and colleagues in academia, in universities, and people who are, as people, what people in the universities call religionists, which is more than faintly condescending way of describing people who have a religious belief. There's a big gap between religionists and academics who are art historians and theorists. And I wanted to write a book that would allow them to talk, because some people that I know, wouldn't give the time of day to anyone who tries to mention religion or spirituality in the context of fine art. But I have not succeeded in this. And as Raphael said, I haven't gotten any invitations except this one. If from anything except religious organizations, there may be an exception next year at MIT. They're planning a conference there, but that's a kind of postmodern, post-theology kind of conference, so not really sure. The moral here is a pessimistic one, and that is that I think that academics, non-religious academics in the art world, are much more alienated from religious practices than religionists are from academic practices. Right, so there are 3 forms of the absence in talk about contemporary art. First of all, religion is absent from art magazines and journals, except when it's critical of religion, and I'll be giving some examples of this. I suppose I'm going to be in the way of everybody, but I can't really walk around here, so I may have to go back up on stage after all. Second, religion is absent from most of the central texts on modernism and postmodernism. Here's a fabulous example that I use as an epigraph in my book. A friend of mine, Tim Clark, who teaches at Berkeley, says, "I will have nothing to do with the self-satisfied leftist claptrap about art as substitute religion." How's that for something harsh to say? That basically means that he won't talk to most of the people that I'm concerned with in my book. There's also a new textbook called Art Since 1900 in English, multiply authored by 4 of the architects of postmodern art theory, and this book gives very little space to religious artworks, virtually none. And a third reason, a third kind of absence, is that religion is absent from the pedagogy of studio art, from the teaching of studio art. Students, art students, can't get critiques about the religious nature of their artworks in most art academies and art schools. And students are not taught how religious ideas are expressed, students aren't taught how religious ideas are expressed, can or have been expressed. So given those absences, I suggest 5 models for the separation or the relation between religious meanings and contemporary art, and this is the way this talk is going to be structured according to these 5. First of all, avowedly religious art. If you make art that it actually claims and says that it is religious, then it's probably a pretty good chance that you won't be able to get in major art shows. Second, art that can be assigned to new faiths. I found out when I was researching this book that the politically correct way to say things like New Age is not politically correct. The politically correct way to say is NRM, which is New Religious Movements. Three, art that is critical of religion. Like I said, that's a kind of pass key to get into the art world if you're critical of religion. Four, art that burns away liturgy to find viable belief. This is the most important category, I think, into which a number of contemporary artists that are quite interesting fall. And five, art that can be said to be unconsciously religious. I'm also very interested in this category. I have students in Chicago where I teach. I teach in Ireland and in Chicago. And in Chicago, I teach in an art school. And a lot of the students there, some of the students have practices that are really religious, but they don't think of them that way. They don't even know that they're doing something which is connectable to religion. And so that's what I call unconsciously religious. They're making liturgical objects, but they don't know that they are. They don't think they are. Okay, so I'll give examples of each one of these. First then, avowedly religious art. There are four themes within this that I want to highlight here. First of all, art world venues for religious art are rare and idiosyncratic. Second, native styles are widely accepted. I was a juror years ago in a show called Religion and Art, or Religion and Contemporary Art, something like that. And for 3 days, I sat with the jurors looking at hundreds of submissions. And we got a couple of them that were very kind of intriguing. One of them was kind of abstract leaf shapes. And then one of my fellow jurors read the artist's statement, and the artist said, "I'm a practicing monk." And one of the other jurors said, "Oh, no, we can't have that," and wouldn't let them in the show. So if that person had not said they were a monk, if they had said, say, I'm you know, Tibetan Buddhist, we might have let them in. And later on in that same exhibition, we got a submission from someone who had given us a kind of a round mandala-shaped abstraction. We didn't know what it was, it looked abstract. And then the artist statement said, "I'm a Native American, and I work with my own belief system." And one of the other judges said, "Great, that's fabulous, let's take that." Right, because it's native, somehow authentic. Right. Third theme is that art commissioned by churches and temples is usually watered-down modernism. Not cutting-edge modernism, but watered-down modernism. And the fourth theme in this category, that religious art can be too sentimental and too unironic for the art world. And I'll give you some examples of that. So the first theme, that art world venues for religious art are rare and idiosyncratic. There are a few permanent museums of modern religious art. There's one in St. Louis in the States, and there's one in the Vatican. And how many of you have been to that, the one in the Vatican? Modern religious art, it's an amazing museum. This museum, last time I checked, the Vatican was so, I don't want to say ashamed, but let's say ambivalent about their own museum that it's not on their website. But if you go there, you see 20th century religious art that is officially sanctioned. It's not important religious art, not important modernist art. Most of these are temporary exhibitions, and I'll give you a few examples. Here's one called Five Artists, Five Faiths that was last year in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, in the States. And the idea here was kind of pedagogic. So on the website, you can go from the artists, see the list of the artists on the left, you can go from the artists through links, you see the link in red on the right, to the faith. So from that artist to their faith. Right. So it's really very, this show was really very instructionally minded, kind of utilitarian show. So here's one representing Islam. This is the page that's supposed to introduce you to Islam, if you need introducing to it. And Ahmed Mustafa is the name of the artist, you see that in red. And here's his page, and it says there that he makes, let's see, where is that? He turns to calligraphy and the cube to express his belief and makes these calligraphic forms on cubes. What I say at the top of the screen there is that one of the problems with this kind of art is that it can seem to a quote-unquote religionist, to a Muslim, for example, might seem not offensive, but unnecessary or extra liturgical. In other words, it doesn't directly confront the religious practice, but it appears as an ornament to it. And that's why shows like this very seldom attract much controversy, because they can be directly and immediately accessible and acceptable to the different faiths in question and not actually intervene in them. Here's one another example of an exhibition, one I've contributed to, called Faith in Hartford. I just wrote an essay for this that wasn't, I'm not the curator of this. This one is typical in that it has a miscellany of works of different styles, different sorts, because the person doesn't really have a theme except that he's interested in faith. So this is a fellow named Matt Collishaw. He makes videos. And these videos are, to me, reminiscent of, well, what I said there was The Passion of the Christ, that Mel Gibson film. In other words, very, very robust, bloody kind of sense of what counts as religious, mingled with Salvador Dali kind of kitsch colors. So this is Collishaw, Matt Collishaw. Archie Rand, I think, teaches at NYU. I've never met him. And this is one of his pieces in that show called God Must Be, and the person says, God must be in this place, but I didn't know it, 3 exclamation points, in a kind of Matisse classical landscape, which also reminded me of Poussin, themes of Poussin. And this is a woman named Arlene Sachet, or Sachet, who I also don't know, who does these kind of Buddha-like figures, and I'm going to return to work like this later in this lecture. So this is to show the kind of miscellany that often goes into these shows, so that they avoid proposing, say, a single theme in favor of invoking something which becomes very, very nebulous, this idea of faith in a kind of very general sense. I will try not to do that too many times. Here we go. Faith is indicative, then, I think, of a lack of theorizing on this subject. Second theme is that native styles are very widely accepted by the art world, and there's a little list of the kinds of things that art world people might accept. Regional, local, native, tribal, provincial, indigenous, vernacular styles. And I give you just one example out of many, many, many. This is an artist named Felix Espinoza. He's Peruvian, and he works in a number of different styles. On the left there, kind of School of Paris style, a little bit like Soutine or someone like that, very colorful. But then he also has a vernacular style, as in on the right. Now, I don't know, I'm not an expert on Peruvian popular religious imagery, but this looks very much like things that are made in Mexico and in Central America, and I imagine that if I knew more about Peruvian imagery, I'd be able to spot something specifically Peruvian in that. Anyway, I'm willing to assume it's authentic. So that can work for a certain kind of an art world public as something authentic, because it's outside of their experience. It belongs to a kind of popular native tradition, as it were, whereas something like the one on the left, those School of Paris paintings that have religious themes in them would be absolutely not accepted. Third theme, then, that within this heading, art commissioned by churches and temples is usually watered-down modernism, and I won't say anything more about that here, except that the School of Paris kind of paintings are typical of that. In the book, I do a lot more about this, because especially in the States and in the UK, especially in the Protestant context, a lot of the quote-unquote modernist art in churches is basically, say, a little pinch of expressionism and a little bit of cubism, and it's very timid. That's what I mean by watered down. And this is actually, this is not news. Like, you know, this is a widely known phenomenon in Protestant communities in North America and the UK, that there is this relation of the church, in that case, the Protestant church, to that kind of art. Cutting edge art, expressionist of any sort, and cubist is not common in churches at all. Here's an example of an Israeli artist who I don't know, just a student found this for me, Yoram Ra'anan, who makes Jewish mystical paintings. And this is the kind of thing that would be fairly typical in art world settings as well. Oh, this is his website. So he's very careful to say exactly what the religious narrative is in each one of his pictures. Melchizedek at the top, the gift of Melchizedek. And by the way, see up at the very top there in red letters, sold. This is very common on artists' websites. Those of you who aren't artists, I don't have to tell any of you who are artists, but there are thousands of artists' websites around the world set up, you know, just by the artist, run by the artist. And I would say the majority of them say sold on half the things on it. If you go back 3 years later, it's still going to say sold on that. Nothing will change. So I think if you actually were to contact, in many cases, they'd sell you the thing, right? So at any rate, there's a kind of semi-abstraction that's favored in Jewish religious art that also wants to have a kind of modernist sense to it. This is one of Yoram's paintings called A Prayer, not quite abstract. So one of the virtues of working in this way in the Jewish tradition is that you are conformed with the prohibition against images. which is, of course, a very fraught issue within the Jewish tradition. And there's recent scholarship on this, which seeks to show that the Jewish tradition was not always, didn't always work with this prohibition against images. In fact, there are some interesting passages in the Talmud which talk about artists' colors and palettes and so. But that's another question. With contemporary artists, there's often this interest in being abstract or quasi-abstract, but it's not completely abstract because the idea of a praying figure, maybe even hands, is more or less visible in this. It also has the advantage, this style does, of having an affinity with high modernism, first generation abstraction, Kandinsky, people like that. And it can also allow the a Jewish artist to get in touch with their Kabbalistic, their mystical heritage, 16th century and onward, 18th century heritage. So there is a kind of solution here within the Jewish tradition to being a modernist and also working for, in this case, the temple or the synagogue, which is parallel to the case of the Protestant tradition. In both cases, kind of watered down modernism is what results. Here's another example. Paul Myhill, petroglyphic paintings, which he spells wrong. I've been saying mean things about this guy in these lectures. I don't know him. I shouldn't say mean things because I've never met him, but he should spell petroglyphic right if that's the kind of painting he does. And he does things like this, which are basically derivative of Van Gogh, mixed with decorative elements, maybe some 60s kind of, you know, tie-dye t-shirt kind of colors or something like that. But there's a feeling sometimes in expressionist church art that that the religious content can be adequately expressed by, say, very, I don't know, vibrant colors and by motion, so that the bending of the crosses here is, you know, is an expressive motif. The idea behind that is a little odd, because one would think that the crucifixion couldn't be adequately expressed by just bending it a little bit and using bright colors. But there's very often this sense, especially in Protestant art, that a kind of expressionism is suitable for a religious theme, common in churches then. Here's another art example that would be, I would think, a little bit more acceptable in art world context. Eleanor Milne is a Canadian artist. And she does stained glass, as you can see on the left, but she also does prints. And her prints derive from German Renaissance traditions, Martin Schongauer and people like that. And that itself has a good intellectual, a good lineage, because Schongauer and Albrecht Dürer and artists like those were revived in the teens and 1920s by German expressionists seeking for a kind of religious or spiritual connection with their past. Fourth theme within this category, religious art can be too sentimental for the art world. It can be perceived as too unambiguous or too unreflective or too sweet. I have some slides in this lecture that I put in specially for a version of this that I gave in California to a college called Westmont College in Santa Barbara. Unless any of you happen to have lived in Santa Barbara, you've probably never heard of this college. I never had. It's a Christian college. Very liberal, ecumenical, multi-denominational Christian college for well-to-do students, well-to-do parents. They have in their brochure saying, if you want your son or daughter to have a very broad-based education in the latest the humanities and postmodernism, then this is a good place, and yet we'll keep you within the Christian context. And then a little bit farther down, like two or three pages down in the brochure, it says, needless to say, homosexuality is not tolerated on this campus. So they have a kind of a other side to them, this Westmont College. So when I gave my talk there, I put in a few slides that I put in these intentionally because I wanted to see if it would disturb the students. So this is the first set that I put in, thinking that I might bother the students. This is a person named John Bell, who does Christian art. This is from his website. Which he sells as postcards and posters, and they always have verses from the Bible down at the bottom. And here's another one. You are my hiding place, you will protect me from trouble and surround me with songs of deliverance. These did bother the students in Westmont College a little bit, because they were concerned that non-Christians, from their point of view, would think that all Christians are very sentimental. But it wasn't so much these that bothered them as an artist named Thomas Kincaid. Any of you know him? Several of you do. He's a person who claims he's the most successful artist in the United States. He claims he's the richest artist in the world. He's not, because the richest artist in the world, as far as I know, is that English artist who does work for the Saudi royal family, I can't remember his name at the moment. Thank you. Probably the richest. But at any rate, Kincaid would be a close second because he creates planned communities now. He's also made himself into an architect, and he does design and all kinds of things. Anyway, Kincaid does, his signature pieces, for those of you who don't know, are very, very technicolor, thatched-roof English cottages with neon-colored flowers and cute rabbits with floppy ears and rainbows and spots of dew on the grass. And they're incredibly picturesque and sappy and saccharine and so on. The students at Westmont College didn't like this kind of thing, or especially Kincaid, because they were afraid, not because it was kitsch, but because they were afraid that people, quote-unquote, like me, people from outside their religious community, would think that they were all sentimental, like Thomas Kincaid. I should say, for those of you who don't know, Kincaid presents himself as a good Christian artist, and a lot of the work in his work sells to Christian communities. On the other hand, when I showed this slide to my art school that I teach at in Chicago, everyone immediately thought this was funny because it reminded them of pedophilia. That should show you the kind of gulf that we're talking about here between the two sides. This is more of Bell's work. These images are made with a computer program called Bryce, or one that's very close to Bryce, because I've used Bryce. And it's a program where you design your own landscape. You make the mountains, and then you decide what color they should be, and you put in the ocean, then you put in some clouds, and so on. Because apparently the real, actual landscape wasn't beautiful enough for this fellow Bell, so he had to do things like this. Okay, on to my second topic of these five, and that is new faiths, NRMs. Art that's made in the name of new faiths has a couple of characteristics. One is that it's often very syncretic in its symbolism. That is to say, taking from various places. And here I have, there it is, Pierre Portelli's, and where is he? He's here somewhere, isn't he? There he is, yeah. A very, very low-resolution scan, sorry to say, of a piece of yours. And by the way, so I've incorporated, since Raphael's given me yesterday some digital scans of some pieces that are actually in this exhibition, and I guess a couple of others that aren't in the exhibition. So if you're the artist in question, and if I say something that's wrong about your work, be sure to tell me, because this will stay in the lecture. First thing you know, someone in Oklahoma will come to you and say, you know, I heard something funny about you. So at any rate, here, a mixture of Christian imagery and tarot cards and maybe some other things in there as an example of syncretic mixing of systems, belief systems. Now, since I don't know anything else about your work, I won't draw any conclusions from this. Sometimes people who do who mix and match kind of symbols, are trying to build new faiths. Other times they're trying to comment on existing faiths. I'll give you another example. Another dimension of this, and that is that art that's made in the name of new faiths is often very inventive in its symbolism. That particular piece is not, you weren't inventing symbols, but you were putting them together. But also people do invent symbols. And here's a nice example of that, kind of fun example of that. Rose is spiritual art. There's Rose. Yeah. I like the bottom paragraph here. I have worked as a professional spirit guide artist and psychic for the last 15 years and been featured on the Australian news show Today Tonight in the documentary Prophecies for the Future. And she's featured in Australian Psychics Directory 2005. So anyway, this is Rose's website. So she does things like this, where she creates images. In this case, as in a lot of her work, there's a kind of an Indian motif. And this is part of a whole series of paintings that she's done representing moods or emotions or passions. I don't know what she would call them, temperaments. This one's balance. On the left is Ganesha, that is the Hindu elephant god, spelled in a funny way, by the way, which makes me think she took this from a German text, Ganesha, S-C-H-A. At any rate, the iconography there on the left is, broadly speaking, acceptable Hindu iconography. She's not changing the iconography of it, so it would be acceptable as a Ganesha to a liberal Hindu observer. But the thing on the right is completely invented. Invented using bits and pieces of Hindu iconography. And she's especially interested, Rose is especially interested, in the rishi dot that Hindus put in their forehead, and she puts it all over the place. She puts these rishi dots all over the place, and I could tell you a little story about that to indicate that this is not correct practice. A friend of mine went to India for a couple months to study under a yoga master, and she, this friend of mine, also found that in India you can buy these packets of stick-on rishi dots in all different, you know, Saturns, moons, stars, everything. And so she put, my friend, put a bunch of them all over her face, sort of like they are over this hat, and she was standing waiting for a bus in Delhi, and this woman came up to her and pushed them all together into one dot. So I would assume, not knowing anything more about this, that there might be something a bit wrong with that one on the right. So being inventive with the intention, in this case, of actually creating a kind of a workable new faith. It goes without saying one of the limitations of NRMs is that they often only work for a very small community. They work for a small number of people who can find them persuasive. I move from there a little bit closer to the art world. This is an artist named Shazia Sikander, and she does different kinds of things. She's stolen from a Renaissance painting. Some of you may recognize, right? I show my relative ignorance of Indian sculpture by not knowing exactly what sculpture that is, but obviously it's taken from an Indian monument. And then she does landscapes like this, which are from Persian miniature painting, with abstractions put in the place of the figures, but very gestural kinds of abstractions. But the stuff that I think would play, the particularly best in the art would be this kind of thing, because it's abstract, and this, where she does the collages of all different things. She's got the, you know, Venus de Milo kind of figures and dancing women from Persian miniature paintings and jet planes. And I have no idea where she got this hat from. Maybe somebody could tell me. It's like a kind of crazy Phrygian kind of, you know, circus hat or something like that. But anyway, the reason why something like that on the left or in the middle maybe might be a little bit more acceptable to a wider range of art galleries, it would be that it's historically specific in ways that Bell's work, for example, the previous work, for example, wasn't. Third theme, art that criticizes religion. So here are two famous examples of that, Andres Serrano's Piss Christ and Chris Ofili's Holy Virgin Mary. I choose these two examples. They're kind of talismanic examples of things that are crazily successful in the art world, and that are taken by the popular press to be direct attacks on Christian values, or even on just plain ethical values, community values. Both of these have caused big controversies. I'm sure I don't have to describe the one on the left. The one on the right, in case you don't know, is made partly with elephant dung. And the little tiny sort of, these little bits and pieces that you can see on the little scan there are little bits and pieces from pornographic magazines that are cut out and then pasted onto the picture. So she's a black Madonna made partly out of elephant dung, resting on elephant dung with pornographic pictures around. Obviously, both of these were easy targets for conservative politicians. However, I choose these two not just because they're the most famous of the last decade or so, but because they both have actually a greater degree of complexity. And it's the complexity that's allowed them to continue to be sort of in the mind of people in the art world. In both these cases, these are seriously religious people. Andres Serrano's house is actually filled with Spanish Baroque sculpture, wooden sculpture, which he loves and collects. And he is Catholic, and Chris Ofili as well is very serious about his faith. And, by the way, I should say parenthetically, Chris Ofili is also serious about elephants, and he has a little farm where he takes old elephants and helps them to lead a happy old age. So it's the initially what got these works their public notice was political. Politicians thinking that they were critical of religion. That was the entryway, that was the door that opened for these artists into the art world. But what's kept them in the press more or less, and it's not as if they're in the headlines anymore, but more or less what's kept them is the fact that actually their attitudes are very ambivalent to religion. It's not that they're just making simply a criticism. Another example closer to what's acceptable to art world in general, Atul Dodia, who's an artist that I don't know personally. She works on themes of Indian politics. And this is one of those metal shop doors that are common, I guess, all around the world. And she has, when you roll it down on the right, she has religious motifs that are done in a conventional way. But when you roll it up, what would be the view into the interior is women who've hanged themselves. And that, of course, refers to an ongoing epidemic of these suicides and also murders in India. So it's very activist art, but it's also very much of its time and place. And because it mixes media, it also makes it even more acceptable. And this one I found because it was in the Yokohama Biennial in 2001. So an example of something which is critical of religion, that would be its sort of entry point, but that it needs something else in order to sustain it. And generally, I would say that the art world accommodates anything that's more or less an ambiguous criticism. Accent on criticism, right, but still with ambiguity, but not when the work is too straightforward. And now I'm going to show you an example of that, Apple, that I, when I gave my talk in Westmont College, I had to check this next example with the dean before I went there, and it passed through a committee to make sure that I could show it. This is a fellow named Paul Booth. If you Google this, if you Google this site, turn up the volume on your computer, right? And make sure you have a broadband connection, because this guy's site takes about 10 minutes to load, and then you get this barrage of heavy metal music, and the screen flashes all around, and skulls come in and out. And this guy basically trying to scare you with his kind of heavy metal image. And he does tattoos and also covers for heavy metal CDs. And I'll show you, there's an example of a tattoo that he does, evil pumpkin tattoo on the shoulder. And down, this is also a blog. So down at the bottom, somebody wrote, "That's fucking nice," right? And he says something, "I hope someday to have something that impressive," he says at the bottom of this guy. So he does religious images as well. And this guy, Paul Booth, and his idea of religious images is kind of like an extreme version of Mel Gibson. In other words, he wants to try to get across to you the passion of the passion by making it even scarier than it has been in any other representation. So Jesus becomes like something out of a vampire movie. And the most extreme image, this next one I'm going to show, is the one I had to get permission from the people at Westmont to show. Jesus chewing off his own finger. The idea, presumably, is something like the crucifixion wasn't enough. Right? It has to be something like even more violent. And this was even too much for his fans. At the bottom, someone wrote, "Is Jesus eating his own finger?" And then he put his little devil with his tongue sticking out, his little thing, to show that like it was cool. Right? So this is an example of art that would be absolutely unacceptable in the art world. No way this guy could ever get a show in a serious gallery, but largely because it's not ambiguous at all. It's absolutely and totally straight ahead, unironic, unambiguous, but in a sense, extremely serious as well, and that's a part of its, you might say, fatal flaw. On a lighter note, this is a guy named Michael Payne, and he has a collection of works called the Godless Collection, and a website which you can get to by googling atheist artist. But it's really not about atheism altogether. It's really about the 700 Club, the television show, which is an evangelical television show. And notice the name of the guy who has the credit card, Sapp, Doug Sapp. And this is the end of a JavaScript movie that's on his website, in which at the beginning of the movie it says something like, "Would you like to see heaven?" And then as the movie runs, this bright light comes forward, and then when the light is completely blinding, you get this thing that says 404 error, not found. The afterlife you were seeking does not exist or may not exist, and that kind of thing, right? Yeah. So. But this has the exact same flaw as Paul Booth does, and that is to say, no, really no irony. It's funny in this case, and Paul Booth is serious, but in the sense, the meanings are very, very unambiguous. Slightly more ambiguous is this kind of thing. Non-controversial Christ painting under fire from art community. This is something which is in imitation of an English language newspaper called The Onion that some of you may know comes out of the States, but it's on the internet. It's been around about 15 years. They do this kind of satirical stuff. After 9/11, The Onion ran, all their articles are jokes. They ran an article after 9/11 saying, "Local man confused when it's okay to take the flag down." That's the kind of thing that they do. So this is what they're doing here, is making fun of people who can't stop themselves from reacting against anti-religious art. And here somebody says, quote, why isn't this painting splattered with donkey semen? Asked sculptor India Jackson, one of the protesters. And I defy anyone to find a trace of urine, that kind of thing. So this kind of thing, which sort of twists around and becomes ironic, gets a little bit closer to something that might be acceptable if it were to be presented as a fine art project. Okay, on to my last two categories, which I think are also the most important ones. The fourth category, art that burns away liturgy to find viable belief. So some themes here. First of all, for these artists, liturgy, and I have a list there, ritual, holy text, church hierarchy, vestments, narratives, calendars, credenda, they're all mistrusted. The idea of this kind of artistic approach is that the church does represent something true and real and living and viable and important, but that the institution of the church has kind of encased it with something that's not viable, that makes it so that it can't be trusted. Second theme, the artists here are after something that's thought to be within those forms, hidden within them. And I mentioned there a wonderful book by Rudolf Otto called The Idea of the Holy, which I recommend to everyone. He's a theologian, early 20th century theologian, who tried to reconcile basically Kant's aesthetics with a sense of the sublime, with a sense of religion, and came up with an idea of what he called the holy. And basically, the idea is the same kind of thing as what I'm outlining here, and that is that the church has grown sort of like a crust of all kinds of unbelievable rules and institutions that have to be somehow chipped away, and inside is the thing that he calls the holy. Otto is the one who coined the word in English, numinous. Numinous is a fabulous word in English if you've never seen it. If you look up numinous in the dictionary, you get a definition like the immediate presence of the fullness of the Godhead, something like that. The numinous means to Otto that is nothing less than the absolute, immediate, full, entire, whole presence of the holy without any intermediary of any sort, language or anything. Third theme, that these artists often turn to things like the sublime, negative theology, which I'll say more about in a bit, and Western mysticism. They're very often points of reference for these artists. And the work does not form a school or a style, but it's generally associated with post-structural theology, what's sometimes called post-theology. And I name some people there who work in this field. Derrida, of course, has done work like that. John Caputo, in case you don't know, is a very interesting and really kind of wonderful person, very serious and very humble person who's interested in these kinds of ideas about what happens basically. Well, let's see, how would I introduce this? Like, in a nutshell, the idea is that if you have the bad fortune to have gone through a university and gotten a PhD in philosophy so that your head is completely filled with post-structuralism, and yet you also have a religious belief, what do you do? So these people have conferences about things like God under erasure, that kind of thing. A lot of, you know, post-theology is a very complicated subject. A couple other names there that work in and around that field. So here's another example from the exhibition. And is Mario Abela here? There he is, right. So again, I won't say anything because I don't know anything else about this. But just to say that a lot of times that work like this will be very simple. So that work in this generally, in this fourth category, will be very simple. We'll use simple forms and really not be saying anything about it that you could easily translate into words. I mean, this could be... It's paint, it looks like it could be an oil spill, so there could be something obviously anti-religious about it, but you don't know. It's simple, it's dark, it's kind of austere. That kind of feeling is very common. And here's one of Raphael's pieces. That's still a little bit blurry, isn't it? This is another piece, of course, that I haven't seen, but Raphael's been telling me about what a pain in the neck it was to make and to set up. Names of God on steel plates, right? Names of God in different languages. And I believe that there's the Maltese Allah. There's God in English. So these works very often in this category have to do with austerity of means and a very, very guarded sense of what is actually being said, a lack of drama, even though you could say a blob is dramatic, I don't know, but, you know, a general lack of drama, and austerity also even in terms of colors and textures and things like that. I'll show you what I mean by this. So here's an artist who I had found a little bit before I gave that talk in California. So I gave this material that I'm about to show you, and then afterwards they said this person had been at that college the year before, had been invited because he represents himself as a Christian artist. Makoto Fujimura, he does these kind of very austere, large-scale paintings, often very dark. They're very serious, and they have literary references attached to them. This is from his website. He has a bit of T.S. Eliot, but heard, half heard, in the stillness between two waves of the sea. Very serious and very simple and very economical in its means, and at the same time not trying to be, well, not speaking loudly, you might say. And Fujimura also does light-colored things, but almost completely abstract, the one on the left called Quince. You might see in his works a hint of naturalism, but almost abstract. And his work is in the collection of churches, especially St. John the Divine in New York City on the right, and those are his paintings in the far distance of that scene inside there. St. John the Divine is one of the exceptions, by the way, that proves the rule. That's a very adventuresome church, and they commission people like Kiki Smith and contemporary sculptors and artists who normally are not in churches. At any rate, Fujimura has also been in there. So I have to tell you the story of what happened afterwards. When I finished my lecture, they said, "Did you know he's been here?" And I said, "That's interesting. And we would like to invite me." They said they'd like to invite me to write a catalog essay because this guy was going to have an exhibition there. So would I write a little something when his exhibition came around the next year, which was last year? And I said, "Okay." And I wrote this essay, very short essay. And then the essay was rejected. And the reason that it was rejected is because I said that even people like Fujimura, who approach very closely to contemporary art world concerns, in this case with abstraction and so on, are still not quite acceptable in the art world and still not known. And the person who, I don't know who it was in that case, the dean or one of the administrators at the university there, decided to reject my essay because it was felt that it would be harmful to the feelings of Fujimura to say that he was not widely known in the art world. And I wrote them back and said, "Sorry, he's not widely known in the art world." And that's all it was, a statement of a kind of a, you know, an observation of communities and their differences, but no. So, because they wanted to think that they had complete freedom to make the kind of art that they felt was appropriate. Anselm Kiefer definitely belongs in this category in religious work that he does. Sometimes his work has direct reference to existential kind of themes, Heideggerian themes, and this one says existence on the left and essence on the right. And then other work is dependent on negative theology, alchemy, the Kabbalah. This one has an alchemical reference up in the upper left-hand corner. Negredo is the dark stage in the alchemical process. And negative theology, for those of you who might not know, it's a 2nd, 3rd century AD theological doctrine that says basically you can't say anything positive about God. All you can say is negative things. And I find negative theology is very popular with artists, and Kiefer's taken it very seriously for quite some time because it allows you to proceed sort of into the realm of the religious without, without committing yourself to a positive doctrine. So in a negative theological rhetoric, you say something like, "Okay, we take the sentence, God the Father is in heaven. Well, we know that he's not a man, and he doesn't have a gray beard, and he doesn't sit on a throne, and he's not actually a father, and so on." You keep going subtracting away things. You say he's neither completely omniscient nor completely powerless. He's neither infinitely large nor infinitely small, and you end up in a place which, in a famous medieval text, is called the cloud of unknowing, in which you recognize your inability to make positive statements. This is a very attractive doctrine to artists in the generation of Kiefer because it allows them to explore things without, as you can see, kind of committing themselves. And also the Holocaust. This is a more famous Kiefer picture with his sentence in German, "Dein goldenes Haar, Margarete," which is from a poem by Paul Celan, which is about the Holocaust. And the poem is about a Jewish girl with dark hair and an Aryan girl with blonde hair, represented by, that's supposed to be soot and straw, and this is on a killing, this is the killing fields. So themes of the disappearance and themes of the Holocaust and themes of alchemy and negative theology are mixed in together. And people who are critical of Kiefer do find this kind of mixture to be a problem, but people who are sympathetic with it find it as a kind of experimentation that shows a way forward, you might say. Here's a lesser-known artist, Dodo Jinming, who makes silver prints, mostly of the ocean, I'll show you in a second, but also things like fields, and he prints them, in this case, in negative. And so here's typical kind of pictures that he makes. So this is the kind of thing which when it's meant by the artist to express a religious purpose, is almost acceptable in contemporary art world terms. That's another one. I say almost because this is still a bit too dramatic. And to show you what I mean, I compare this with Sugimoto, Hiroshi Sugimoto. Here's a very successful, internationally known artist. He's not intending these for a religious purpose, but he is famous, among other things, for pictures of very, very calm ocean scenes. If you compare that to Dodo Jingming, you see the kind of thing that's required of this kind of investigation of the sublime or of the negative theological implications. In other words, you have to almost erase content completely from what you're doing in order to be persuasive in an art world context. And a couple more famous examples. Gerhard Richter has done just a few things that have actually to do with religious themes. A rhombus series inspired by St. Francis of Assisi. And I think particularly interesting these candle paintings, which, if they were the only thing that Richter had done, would definitely not be successful in the art world because they would be taken to be too sentimental. But because Richter is very versatile, does lots of other things, then moments, you might say, are permitted. Moments like this are permitted. And among the straightforward kind of conjurings of the sublime would be things like Walter de Maria's lightning field. This is in the desert in the southwest in the States. And it's a field full of lightning rods. You go there for 24 hours. You have to rent in advance, and you stay in a little cottage, and you stay 24 hours, and you hope that it rains. It's the desert, so it hardly ever rains. I've never experienced any lightning. I haven't experienced any lightning there, but I know someone who has, and he said that what happened was all day long it was like this, just a desert day, and then at 3 in the morning they were woken up. And there was lightning crashing all around them, and because it's a whole field of lightning rods, he said it was deafening and terrifying, and lasted for hours, and it was fabulous. So it was a direct encounter with the sublime, and this kind of thing also, even though this is earthworks, obviously has direct and a kind of successful application of this sense, this particular sense of what counts as the religious. And James Turrell would be another person whose interests have very often been related to the sublime. Turrell does pieces like this, where he makes, architectural structures, and what in the world? He does works like this, where he actually will carve out a part of a room, and then he'll light it in such a way that you think you see a certain space, and then after a while you realize you see another space. The ultimate James Turrell piece, by the way, is in Pittsburgh, in a place called the Mattress Factory, where there's an installation called something like the Pleiades, something like that. Maybe one of you knows this, what it's named. And they say that if you go into it and you have to wait full 5 minutes in there in order to see anything, because it's so close to nothing. I went in there, and I was waiting, didn't see anything. You have to grope your way in, right? And I put my hand on someone's head by mistake, right? So you just sort of stand, and you look, and you don't see anything. I never saw anything because my taxi arrived right after about 3 minutes, and someone said, "Your taxi's here." So I went away. And then later I found out that it's actually, there is no light in the room. So that the people who stay there long enough start seeing things, and they say, so they have a truly sublime experience generated completely by themselves. And this is an artist named Kim Suja who does James Turrell-like objects in which you have various kinds of ethereal or spiritual experiences. Sometimes it seems that artwork is most resonant with religion when it has the least content. This is the kind of theme I'm trying to bring out here. So this is a Taiwanese artist who did a piece in which rockets go up in the sky. And he says down at the bottom, "There seems to be less discussion of essence or spirituality in contemporary art these days. I would so like to bring these issues back onto the table," says the artist Tsai Guo Jiang. Says about these things. So very, very little content, nothing but fireworks rockets in the daytime. But with the intention of making contact with something religious. This is the cover of my book, where we got Christo, to give us two pictures for free. And aside from promoting my book, what I'm also doing is showing you this is interesting because Christo knew the content of this book, and he and his wife okayed this. They could have charged us a fortune, but they okayed these two pictures knowing the content of the book, even though they have both been, I think, very careful not to say anything, especially about religion, but in particular about determinate content of their work. But he was happy to be associated with this project. So to me, belongs with Cai Guoqiang and people like that who are doing something almost like just decoration, almost entertainment, almost something that seems to be, by definition, free of theology, and yet is therefore paradoxically very close to it. Okay, my last theme, unconscious religion. I have an artist here who I'm going to put in this category of unconscious religion, even though he's quite, well, quite unusual. He's a bit of him about him in my book, too. His name is Jeffrey Valance. He got interested in this image. This is a detail of the Virgin of Guadalupe, which is a miraculous image that's in Mexico that appeared on the back of a robe. So it's meant to be painted without human hands and on the back of a robe. It's an image of the Virgin. He claims, Jeffrey Valance claims, that he's found simian, ape-like creatures reflected in her eyes. So he took out his microscope, and he looked into her eyes, and he found these are the ape-like creatures, you see, around the right there. And he kept looking and looking and found something like 72 ape-like creatures. In doing this, he's following a very strange tradition there. There was a person who in charge of the restoration or the cleaning of the Virgin of Guadalupe in the 20s who said that he had seen reflected in the Virgin's eyes the priest and the people who were present at the miracle. And according to this person in the 20s, these people are reflected in the two eyes of the Virgin slightly differently. So optically, they are actually accurate. And the claim was that this could not have been done by the artists if there was an artist. The claim was, therefore, there couldn't have been an artist, that it is a miraculous image. And this is accepted, I suppose, informally. And so at Guadalupe, you can get this literature. It's disseminated by the church. So I don't know how, at what level of acceptance it's gotten at the church, but it's accepted at that site. And so Jeffrey Valance was kind of playing off of that, saying, well, let's look again. And that's how he managed to find 72 ape-like creatures. Now, this is a website full of jokes and nonsense, and he's a very postmodern kind of, you know, everything for fun kind of kitsch-loving, camp-loving kind of an artist. But he's also very curious about religion, and he has a long text on his website explaining why it might be appropriate that there were ape-like creatures in the Virgin's eyes, and this has to do with the idea that the ape is a symbol of the bestial nature of mankind and that it's overcome and that we yearn for a more spiritual nature. In other words, Jeffrey Valance is not 100% sure that he's joking. I think he thinks he's joking. I don't think he is actually 100% joking. So this is an example of a kind of thing that I think should be talked about in religious terms, even though so far, as far as I know, it's only treated as a kind of art world joke. And he goes around giving talks at art schools and everyone laughs and has a good time. But I think that you have to ask at a deeper level, why be so interested in finding these things and why continue to write about them? And here's another example. This Rosa Mastica, which I've just heard about, but which sounds like a fabulous piece, where, what is it, bubblegum pieces, right, correspond to the colors. You chew them, you stick them on according to the colors. And was this actually finished by spectators? It wasn't finished. It was a work in progress, but it would take a long time to it would take a long time to actually finish it. It's a very nice thing. I put it in here because Raphael and I were talking about the possibility of the beginnings of humor, or if not humor, then say lack of absolute seriousness as a way of addressing religion. And this is definitely something that's happening in the art world now. But here's more the heart of what I mean by something like being unconsciously religious. This is an artist named Jerry Bleem, who makes objects that are kind of like organs. They're all covered over with staples. These are sculptures, and they look kind of like body parts, especially like hearts. And I chose his work here because in the book, I first started thinking about this because I had a student who made this kind of shape by luck, the same kind of shape, almost like a heart. And that student of mine was absolutely fixated on these things. He treated them very ritualistically and compulsively. His studio was full of them, drawings of them all over the floor, and little ceramic versions of them on shelves nailed to the walls, and versions of them sculptured hanging. And they seemed to me to be clearly something of a kind of strange devotional interest, and also a very kind of ritualized thing, almost like a kind of rosary for him. He had to go through a sequence of them, almost like he had to have them in front of him every day. But no one in the school was going to talk about those as religious things, and it would have surprised him and amazed him if people had started talking about them as religious. So this is what I mean by unconscious religion. None of these are clearly identifiable as objects of any clear sort. And here's my last example from here. And is Anton here? There he is. Oh, Anton. Didn't know why. How did I miss you? So this is a fabulous piece. I say, you know, having never seen the actual thing in the flesh, but I think it's a wonderful piece because it exemplifies very exactly this kind of idea that you have something, you're inventing forms which are not quite identifiable. Let's say, for example, a tool of the passion, something like that. And a figure of some sort of indeterminate gender and parts. Now, this is the difference between this and what I was showing before. Having known Anton for all of like 2 hours or 1 hour, I can't guess about how you're imagining this, but because you've actually named it Stabat Mater, I know from that that this is not unconscious religion. The question here is how levels of articulation of religion in art, and one of the purposes of my book is to try to make these levels accessible, especially to artists like the one before who don't think about it at all. But even in an art world context, it would be nice to have, say, an exhibition, if you had an exhibition of these, this kind of work alone. It would be really wonderful to have someone write an essay who was, have someone that you, a priest that you like, write in the essay, right, to make it serious and explicit about the religious content. Okay, so at the end here, I just want to say that unconscious religion also pertains to things outside the art world. I think they can be extended to popular culture. For example, this. I think The Matrix is nothing if it's not a religious movie. I mean, what is the entire idea of looking to try to find an outside, right, an underlying reality of experience that's outside the visible, et cetera, et cetera? I know that the normal criticism of The Matrix is that it's Marxist, that we all live in a society, in a state of unknowing of the real values that are outside of us, and that the true Marxist revolution will come and wake us up, and so on. But if you think about the Matrix, the first movie, at the end of that first movie, he makes a phone call. He says something enigmatic. But if you think of it as a Marxist critique, what he really should have done was he should have got on that phone and said to whatever, whoever he was talking to, let all those people go, and then they would have come out of their pods, and the movie would have ended with a truly horrific and really genuinely Marxist revolution in which these fields of bodies would have come out of their pods all screaming in terror. And it would have made a great ending, could have made it a masterpiece. And that would have been a kind of Marxist critique, because then they would have become aware of that they had been dreaming their whole lives and that they were now alive. But it's not, doesn't end that way, of course. It's much more religious metaphors that are at work in The Matrix. And I think from here on, things, the farther you get into popular culture, the vaguer all of these things get. But that doesn't mean that they become invisible. Fine art dissolves into popular culture and then into vague illusions. For example, Battlestar Galactica. If Malta or not, but this is a very popular show in some parts of Europe and comes out of the States. And in this, you have two people looking for Earth, right, in some future society. And the fact is basically the materialist. He's the general, I guess, because I've only seen this a few times. I'm not an expert, but he's the general. He's hard-nosed. He knows how to do things right, and he has no beliefs. And the woman there is the president of this, whatever, last remaining humans or whatever it's supposed to be. And she has belief. She has mystical beliefs, in fact, that nobody can really understand, but she's going to lead them on. And my last example, The Truman Show, this movie about, this guy who lives his whole life and doesn't realize he's actually on a television show, right, being watched by some figure. So I mean to say here that the farther you go away from fine art, the vaguer things get. I would include Christo again in this kind of field, a field which is the more it broadens out to a wider and wider public, the harder it is to find the content. But maybe in that, for that exact reason, the closer that it gets to religious content. So there's no ending because there's no way to end this stuff. That's the end of the lecture. Thanks.
Campus FM presents a talk entitled On the Strange Place of Religion in Contemporary Art by Professor James Elkins. The talk was organized by the art program within the Faculty of Education.